Hello, and welcome to The Leap of Faith. This week we leave the studio and head to the Organ Gallery of the Pro-Cathedral in Dublin, where during the week I met with Dr. Gerard Gillan, who for the last 42 years has been the titular organist at the Pro-Cathedral, and who last Sunday retired from the position at a special mass. While sitting at the organ with the sounds of Dublin traffic in the distance, I began our conversation by asking Gerard Gillan how he started his musical career.
Well, I suppose quite by accident. The mixture, I suppose, of nurture and nature. My father had been a boy chorister in St. Andrew's Western Row, and his proud boast was that he was the head chorister, and he was paid a princely sum of, I think it was 2 shillings a week. So, I mean, the music was in the family, but the real impetus for organ in particular, and even for piano in general, came from our next-door neighbour. I lived in Inchicore. And my next door neighbour happened to be a church organist, a very good church organist. He was organist of Adam and Eve's church, the Franciscan church. And he took me under his wing and introduced me to the organ at a very early age. I was only about 8 or 9. And I remember playing for my very first service in Merchant's Quay, Adam and Eve's church. And I was as nervous as a kitten, as you can well imagine. So nervous that I think I had completed the second verse of the Tantum Ergo before the congregation had finished the first. That didn't sound very good. Well, it got a bit better thereafter. And then I studied the piano, entered the what is now the DIT, was then simply the Municipal School of Music, and was very fortunate to have wonderful teaching there. So it was a wonderful place. And I became one of the first organ students there. And they appointed a very fine man, Sidney Greig. Sidney Greig was organist at that time of the Presbyterian Church, Finlayters Church, just in Parnell Square, and then very soon became organist of St. Patrick's Cathedral. He was a very fine musician and an excellent teacher. And I became a pupil of his right through my secondary school years, right into university, in fact. And that's where it began seriously. Then I was appointed at an early age organist of the Oblate Church in Inchicore, which was my home patch, and which in those days of great religious fervour was a church of endless services. And it was demanding, I can tell you. But the one thing it did teach one how to play a sound, how to be inventive.
There was also that, of course, moment for the organist as communion was going, where you maybe had the opportunity to vamp a little bit and go a little bit longer than you expected.
Absolutely, and to improvise and encourage, because the art of improvisation is central to the organist art. Any organist really worth his or her salt will improvise, and there are some really spectacular examples of phenomenal improvisers, and we have some very good ones here in Ireland as well. But what you learn to do that through the necessity, if you're to do your job properly, you can't just stop playing and allow the action to continue without providing some sort of musical connectivity to the next act, as it were.
Let's go back a little bit then in your own formation, because you found yourself then going from Dublin to Antwerp.
Well, that happened later. So I took a year out of university. I was halfway through my BMus degree at UCD, and I was fortunate enough to win the scholarship. And I took a year out and went off to Antwerp to study under one of the great organist composers, teachers of the time, a man called Floor Peters, who was very, very distinguished. And I really reformed myself as a player as a result of that. And I worked very hard, very little else to do over there. I was, when I think of it, that was 1963. My first time away from home. Antwerp is not so far, it's only an hour or less than an hour away now, but then it was like going to Australia. I presented myself at the Irish Consul. We had an honorary consul there, who was a Belgian. He was thrilled to see an Irish person. He hadn't come across him for ages. Then he told me I was the only official Irish resident in Antwerp in 1963, which is amazing. I think the population, the Irish population in Brussels was just, if it was 100, it was that. So I was very lonely. I really was terribly lonely. I had a terrible homesickness. But I got over that, and I suddenly discovered the joys of Belgian beer, which I had been a teetotaler up to then. I also discovered the wonders of continental cheeses. I'd been brought up on two types of cheese, hard cheese and soft cheese. But now there was this rich variety. Initially they all stank, of course, but I discovered I wouldn't get adapted fairly easily and quickly. And then I became, of course, made great friends. And Antwerp is still one of my most favourite places. I escape there whenever I can.
What was the music you were introduced to there?
Well, of course, the music would have been the great music of the organ repertoire. Johann Sebastian Bach is of course the greatest composer of all, not just for the organ, but arguably greatest composer, period. So I was introduced to his in a special way, in a manner, in a tradition that was special. Vaupeters could trace his musical ancestry right back to Bach. In that he explained to me once through various teachers how he could go right back to Bach. So I suppose I can say that now.
You're learning from the source.
apostolic succession, as it were. And so I also was introduced to the contemporary French repertoire. The music of César Franck was very, very important to the Belgians, because he's Belgian, of course. Even though we regard him as French, he was in fact Belgium, and Germanic in his background. He was César Franck. Franck is a German name rather than a French name. The César bit is French. But there was that sort of Germanic background to this composer who is now regarded as French. And of course, he spent most of his life in Paris.
We're sitting here, as we've mentioned earlier on, in the Pro-Cathedral in front of the organ. What might be nice for our listeners this evening as well would be to broaden people's awareness of Bach's music and why it seems to work so well for the organ.
Well, it's just that you have a composer of sheer extraordinary genius choosing this instrument as one of the principal means of his creative communication. He summarized a whole era in music, that the Baroque era. He was the last composer of the Baroque period. Music changed utterly after that. We were into Mozart and Haydn. His sort of music became very quickly totally unfashionable. But I think we see with him a last flowering, and a flowering in a manner that has completely fascinated and riveted the world ever since. So, and he wrote, you know, so much for the organ. He was a church organist, practicing organist for so much of his life. And it was as much his need to fulfill the needs of the Lutheran service as it was an absolute urgency he had to create at all costs. That's a feeling that all composers have. I think they just have to compose whether they want to or not, as it were.
Tell us about the organ itself, actually, its history.
Well, this instrument is what they call a romantic organ. Maybe I'll just play you a few examples, building it up. It can go from extreme slowness and extreme beautiful graciousness, that's the lovely warm, what we call, now you might hear a crescendo coming, that's because that division of the organ I'm playing is called swell, and that's encased in a box which I'm operating with my right foot here, opening it. And I'm closing it now. They're known as the string stops of the organ. And then you can have the reeds. They're the trumpets, things like that, you know. Basic, it's what they call the diapasons. That's the basic family of sounds of the organ. Mm-hmm. yourself. Then, just a touch of one of the most famous of all pieces for the organ, Toccata, written by Charles-Marie Vidor. That's probably the most famous piece after Bach's great Toccata and Fugue in D minor, which is, of course, the Disney Fantasia piece. But that became very famous, that Vidor Toccata, because it was chosen for one of the royal weddings in England way back in the 1960s. And since then, it has been the piece of choice for weddings, royal and non-royal, all over the world.
Not only do you hear that piece, but sitting here in the Pro Cathedral, you feel it.
Yes, that's a great piece. It's a great piece. It suits this building and suits this organ so well.
And facing that retirement, I'm guessing you're not going to stop.
No, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to stop my form and connection here with the Pro Cathedral, because I think one has to do this at some stage, and it's better to do it at a time of one's choosing rather than to be getting hints about doing so. And we have wonderful music here. We're so fortunate with the Palestrina Choir, and it's very demanding music. But as I get older, I find that's becoming a little more stressful. So I think it's probably time to pass that particular baton on to a younger person, which I am doing. But I'm certainly continuing to play. Yes, I will very happily play as deputy, as I've acquired by organists wanting a break. And I'm still keeping up my international recital work. Next year I'll play at King's College Cambridge, Queen's College Oxford, Antwerp Cathedral, and so on. So it's nice to be able to do that. And that's one of the nice things about the organ. One gets to play in lovely places, sometimes out of the way places. This year, for example, I was in Slovakia, in the middle of Slovakia, in cities and towns that I'd never heard of before. But you felt you were part of, back again in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Beautiful, beautiful cities with great histories, and particularly the churches telling wonderful stories. So I'll continue to do that as well. I'll do a bit of teaching as well.
Tell me a little bit more about the other part of your life, which is the development of other musicians and teaching.
Well, that has been very central to my life. I had another side, as you said, to my string, to my musical bow. I was an academic, and I was a lecturer in UCD first, before moving to Maynooth as professor of music, where I built up what is now it's the largest music department in the country now. And I always enjoyed enormously teaching and engaging with young people. And I think I had a good relationship with them. And that was very, very important. In addition to that, of course, I've taught the organ to generations now. And some of my students have become very, very very fine and very internationally known professional organists. I think of Raymond O'Donnell, who's the organist of Galway Cathedral, a very fine organist. My successor here, David Greeley, a Galway man, a graduate also of the Cologne Conservatoire and a former one of the assistant organists at Westminster Cathedral, is taking over from me, a young man. It's great to see it going to such a talented young person who's also a former student. And then another young student I have, Robbie Carroll. Both of these young men, by the way, are from Galway. I don't know what's in the air there. But he's at present studying in Germany, and I can foretell a very fine career for him. I think particularly of the, here we're sitting here in the Pro Cathedral, where the Palestrina Choir is the resident choir, and that's a choir of boys and men, but young boys, and they all come together and they sing the most complex music with ease, and they're not conscious that it's different to a pop song they maybe have sung the day before. They take it all in their stride. I think that's wonderful.
You've played organs in other countries. Any of them outstanding in your mind?
There have been so many, my heavens. Oh, yes. Some I've been very privileged and fortunate to play some of the great instruments of the world, in some of the great buildings of the world. I think of Notre Dame, Paris. Mitch mentioned I gave a recital there, which was wonderful, and even almost better than playing the wonderful instrument was practicing in that at midnight, all alone in that wonderful cathedral. You could really get a sense of connection with centuries of presences there, past. And that's been an experience replicated all over, particularly Europe, very many. St. Stephen's Cathedral of Vienna comes to mind, Freiburg or Münster in Germany. There's so very many Scandinavian cathedrals, and not only cathedrals, sometimes small little churches. My most treasured memories of going up the fjords in Norway to small churches, which beautiful ones. The Norwegians take their churches quite seriously. People don't take them too seriously, but the state does. And I've been to most extraordinary places there, all right up beyond the Arctic Circle and so on.
And West Cork.
And oh yes, West Cork is very special. That's the Castle Townsend. And Castle Townsend is a beautiful place, very beautiful, beautiful village. Not a typically Irish village, I would have to say. It's probably, I don't insult anybody, but it's more like an English village, but very beautifully so. And there's this wonderful church, Church of Ireland, a little Church of Ireland, which is up on a hill. And it is a church very, very strongly associated with Somerville and Ross. They were the local,
Ayrshire M.
And one of them, Violet Martin, was organist there. I think right up to her death in the 1940s, I think. They have a summer festival going for several years now, and it's developed enormously in recent years, and it's quite a significant festival in the Irish musical calendar. But I gave some recitals there with other musicians, and there's always something very special playing on a very simple, humble instrument, but again, in a beautiful building, and feeling something that you are connecting with these very special people for whom this church and instrument was a very important part of their lives.
You've played at several state occasions.
Yes, I have here. I suppose the first one that is very strongly in my memory is the funeral of Eamon de Valera in 1975, which was a great occasion. He was, of course, the last of the 1916 leaders, and of course, one so terribly important to the formation of the state, and Taoiseach for so long, president for 14 years. So he was a giant who was present in, I think, in every generation of Irish life from 1916 to 1975, one might say. And then I was played also for the reburial of the 1916 leaders when they were exhumed sometime in the 1990s. That was a great service. Up to the 1990s sometime, it was normal for all presidents to have a mass here on the day of their inauguration. And so that ended with President Patrick Hillary. He was the last one to follow that. Then, of course, we had the changing Ireland. Then the ecumenism, I suppose, played some part in that. And they felt that it shouldn't be just a service confined to one religious denomination. And then more latterly, that has taken place. There still is a sort of service that takes place in Dublin Castle on presidential inaugurations. There was always the Dáil. Each new Dáil always began, at least after the formation, after a general election, there was always a mass here for that. That was always quite exciting because politicians, as they came here for mass, it was very obvious their thoughts were on other things as they were preparing for battle in the formation of the government in subsequent hours.
I'm curious that from your vantage point here, which is quite good in the gallery, you see a lot, don't you?
You see everything. It's a wonderful, yes, it's wonderful. Yes, one sees a lot. And one of the memories I have, I can't tell you exactly when, but it relates to Eamon de Valera. I think it might have been, before I became officially organist here in 1976, had been brought in quite often for important occasions. And one was, I remember Eamon de Valera, who was, as we all know, blind and couldn't see very well, and he was escorted to a pew. And then his great political nemesis, going back to, sadly, the Civil War, W.T. Cosgrave, came in as well as an old man. And he was led to the same pew. And as soon as he discovered De Valera, he left the pew and walked out into another pew. Very obvious. I had a first-class view of that little bit of political theatre being played out. The other thing I had, which doesn't relate to the program theatre, but it's a wonderful memory, I was organist for the Pope's visit in 1979. And that wasn't here, that was in the park, but I was organist at the park and also organist in Knock. I was helicoptered to Knock directly from the park to, because I was, park was on Saturday, Knock was on Sunday, and we had to get there and get ready. But that was a wonderful, wonderful memory.
You said to me earlier that we do funerals very well in Ireland. Yes. Fewer weddings that you may have played at, but you played some significant ones.
Well, I have, yes. I played, of course, at the wedding of our president, our present president, Michael D. Higgins, when he married the very, very beautiful Sabina Coyne. In Haddington Road, she had an apartment flat, as they called them in those days, there, and he was a dashing young senator. And I played for the wedding, and they remembered it, because 2 years ago, when they were 40 years married, they invited me to come back to Haddington Road, just for a private visit, and to play the organ, and they came to the gallery and sat around. They didn't have a religious service, but just a little musing over the past, which was very nice. And he remembers that very well. Anytime I meet him, he always refers to it.
Gerard, there are several composers that, of course, that you've mentioned in relation to the organ, Dvorak, and also César Franck. Tell us about those two composers in connection with this instrument.
Well, Sir Franck was the more obviously the organ composer. Franck was an organist. He was organist of the great church of Saint Clotilde in Paris. And he's a composer who, through his composition, revived, gave renewed vigour to the organ. The organ, after the death of Bach in 1750, sort of went into a decline. Other musical instruments became more popular. Of course, the rise of the piano as opposed to the organ and harpsichord, and then the rise of the greater symphony orchestra and all that eclipsed that of the organ. And it wasn't until the 19th century that the organ became popular again. It was due largely to two things. Firstly, there was an organ builder of genius in France called Aristide Cavaillé-Coll, and he built these instruments which are still in Paris and all the great churches today, Notre Dame, Saint Clotilde. And Franck, a combination of these instruments, which by their beauty inspired Franck as much as he inspired the creation of the instruments. They're sort of they had a symbiotic effect one upon the other. And he gave to the organ a renewed lease of life as he brought it very much into to the forefront of music making in late 19th century France. Dvorak didn't write very much for the organ. They're both contemporaries, by the way, more or less. But they wouldn't probably never met, because Dvorak's, well, it was between what we now call the Czech Republic and the United States and so on. Franck was just between mainly France and Belgium in his earlier times. But they had certain traits in common. Dvorak had his musical training as an organist. That's where his initiation. He went to what was called the organ school at Prague, the Prague Organ School, because he was trained as an organist, but didn't actually write very much in a solo capacity for the organ. But it certainly figures in his choral works. The music for the organ was moving from the strictly liturgical to the concert hall. Mm. There was a new era of music making emerging, a new phenomenon, the civic organ. Their organs in concert halls, which they still have in, particularly there's one in Belfast. We've none here in the Republic, but Belfast, the Ulster Hall, has an organ, a civic organ, coming from that sort of mindset. And France had several of them. And Franck wrote specifically for this secular context, as well as the religious. So these pieces, Prelude, Fugue and Variation, the Pièce Héroïque, and Grand Pièce Symphonique, were written for concert hall organ as opposed to a church organ. But of course they work in a church organ as well.
And that's The Leap of Faith for another week. We'll be back next week at the same time We leave you this evening with the music of César Franck, played by Dr. Gerard Gillan. From all of us here tonight, good night.